Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the
Hey everybody, this is Greg Sewell from Texas with the Brothers Wiss number 61. Today I have Andrew Cox all the way from Australia.
Hey guys.
Man, your feed is looking like super clean today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Got shiny new internet here.
Nice. It's usually a little choppy, man, but it's looking good. Mike might be jumping in a little bit later, but nobody feels like waiting on him, so we're just going to keep on trucking. Sound good to you?
Yep.
Excellent. All right, man. First on the list is Meltdown and Spectre. I'm sure everybody listening to this has heard of it by now, but a huge exploit that affects, was it like every Intel-based processor pretty much, made in the last, I guess, relatively the last decade.
Intel and Atom CPUs. I think the only ones that weren't affected, like the Itanium chips or something.
Yeah, isn't it like in, the newest in, generation? You're maybe okay, or am I crazy?
I don't know on that one, but yeah, definitely like everything the last decade and even further back. So
okay, so it seems like, I guess this was properly disclosed to the manufacturers, the major. The major software vendors, so like Microsoft, Linux, and I think Mac have already all released updates, so you should definitely go and update. It's pretty cool. We'll put a link in the show notes to the, well, I mean, it's not cool, but the Meltdown attack, the way it actually allows you to arbitrarily read memory locations and things like that, they have some sample exploit code on there, and it shows them typing in passwords in some of those hidden boxes, and it all just plain text pops up. You know, in this program. So it's definitely problematic. They're saying that they haven't necessarily seen anything in the wild yet. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And also, they're saying that if you are infected, it's hard to tell because most of the programs, I mean, like a program's going to look normal, you know, one that's actually, I guess, taking advantage of this exploit at this point. And if you are infected, it's going to be virtually impossible to tell. Popping in really quick, that's Mike Hammett. Can you hear us, Mike?
Yeah, how's it going?
Going well, man. We were just getting into it, just talking about Meltdown and how interesting that was. So we have a few externally facing things, and we made sure to go ahead and update those really quick. If you're on, say, like a new version of CentOS, it's pretty much just as easy as a yum update. Then you got to reboot. Windows machines, I think, have already released. I know my Windows machine has already pulled some updates. How about BIOS? Is this something you're going to need to update BIOS on systems for?
No. So I had to do a little bit of research into this. We were pretty heavily affected because obviously, well, Microsoft had originally planned to release an update to the Azure infrastructure environment, and they planned that to be for today. So it's supposed to be on the 7th of January. They were going to force anyone that hadn't already rebooted and updated their machines to go ahead. And they do that reasonably often when there's a major update or something that they need to apply to the hypervisors and things up above where our VMs sit. They'll schedule that in, and you can either go ahead and reboot your things at your own leisure, so long as it's before the date where they want to do it, and then they catch any others after that. So we'd scheduled that all in, and then on Wednesday, I'm pretty sure, Google dropped all the details of this security problem. Basically did a big post on the Google security blog ahead of the embargoed release. So that basically forced these other providers to go, well, now Google's told everyone what's going on and just how bad this is. So we need to start updating things immediately. So we got an email from Azure saying, we're going to start rebooting stuff at any moment. So we sort of made the jump and said, look, we'll do all ours now. And then like a day later, they released another update, and this one we didn't even get an email about. We just logged in and saw one of the machines had gone offline and all the others were pending reboots. So that was not fun. But that happened across AU, EU, US infrastructure, pretty much all at the same time. So been a lot of people scrambling to get that sorted.
Yeah.
And just to elaborate on what you were saying, yeah, so the issue is with what they call speculative lookups in the memory on the CPU. It can't be addressed by a microcode update to the CPU. So the only way it can be addressed is by fixing the problem in the operating system itself, like working around the problem in the operating system itself, I should say, which they've done testing on. And basically, as a result of this, certain calls to the CPU have a reduced speed of 10 up to 30% in some instances. So they say, a lot of people won't see an effect, but when you're transferring lots of little files and things, certain workloads will see a huge effect from this.
I think I read that databases are going to take a pretty big hit, right?
Yeah. So anything that's doing a lot of those little, doing a lot of memory lookups and things is affected by this. So
something I was thinking about, and see what your take is on this. Say I have everything hosted in a cloud environment, right? And now, say I'm heavily database utilized, and the rest of my stuff, say it's going to be penalized. Say I'm an average of 20% slower now. Does that mean I'm going to have to bump up my utilization resources by 20% to keep up with my workload, thereby increasing my cloud cost every month? Or is that something do you think that Azure is just going to kind of secretly eat on the back end? I'm pretty sure it's not.
I imagine, given how widespread this is, I would not think they would want to wear that cost at all. And I'm just wondering how long it is until people are saying, I want my money back. Like, if you've bought a CPU that's affected by this and you're using it for that sort of workload and you're seeing that sort of performance hit, yeah, it's a huge deal.
Yeah, and I was curious, is there going to be some kind of class action lawsuit? Because say I'm somebody with some actual muscle. Say I've bought, 30 million CPUs off of Intel. And I was sold, predicated, under the fact off their benchmarks that using this sort of workload, I get this much efficiency. All of a sudden, I've lost 20% efficiency across my entire infrastructure. All of a sudden, you sold me a car with only 3 tires on it when you told me there were going to be 4. Is there actually some recourse for them? Did you think this constitutes gross negligence on Intel's part? From what you can tell, is this a hardware problem? Is this a hardware flaw?
It is a design flaw, something they hadn't anticipated. I think the system that's being used itself is like it was there for a reason, and someone's just not sort of realized this is the case. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
That's interesting, though.
Which one is the one that's Intel only?
Can you wait until I finish talking to do that, please?
Yeah, it's Meltdown is Intel only. Spectre, we haven't even talked about Spectre, but Spectre,
okay,
from what I understand, is harder to actually take advantage of, but it works similarly. And I think it is more ARM focused, right? Can you do that, please?
From what I can tell, basically I'm just reading what other people have written in Slack and whatnot, because I don't have time to look it up myself, is that basically everything other than like MIPS and like one version of ARM is vulnerable to Spectre. Like everything.
All right, so pretty much every smartphone that in existence is theoretically vulnerable.
Yeah, smartphones. I'm thinking, anything that's, not even a computer, an interactive machine.
What, like your cable box and stuff like that?
Yeah, like your cable boxes and ATMs and, display boards and, because they're,
things that aren't going to get updated for a long time.
That, You know, there's, you know, different power CPUs, and something IBM's do. I mean, it's an extensive list of things that are vulnerable to.
So I know we have
variants,
and I know I'm not unique in saying this. I know there's a lot of people like me out there, but we have a lot of old systems that are fairly internal only, and you know, they perform some operations. They've been up and running. I've got over 3 years of uptime on some of these things, but you know, if it's CentOS 5 or older, there is no update for this anymore, right? So, you know, if you're running old stuff inside, I've got an old XP machine cranking away doing some stuff. I've got an old Windows XP machine, an old Windows 2000 server doing some stuff hidden on the inside, right? So these things are absolutely vulnerable, and they're going to stay vulnerable to stuff like this. But I can, you know, I mean, I think whenever you run old stuff like that, you assume those responsibilities. You know that you're not really going to be as protected as you ought to be on those older things, no matter what you want to do. You just got to try and lock them down as much as possible and hope for the best. I don't know. Are you guys super worried about this, super paranoid? I'm wondering how much longer it'll be before we see something out in the wild for these things.
I'm not terribly paranoid. I've kind of taken the stand. Something mind-blowing, earth-shattering happens in the security world every couple months. And it's always the end of the world, and nothing ever happens. Just update how you're supposed to, and don't worry about it.
Like, I agree in part. This has huge implications. Like the fact that a program, a seemingly basic program could access your passwords in another program. Like if you use anything like KeyWeb or LastPass or anything like that. Literally, a program can access memory it is not supposed to. So, if someone is out there writing a malware or virus or something for this right now, then any machine that's unpatched is vulnerable. And if you're using that machine for any purpose, so let's say you're on holidays and you use an internet cafe PC to log into your bank account, like you're almost asking to lose money there. Like it's I know there's going to be so many people that don't update their machines or that already don't update their machines. And this, we could see implications from this for a very long time.
Yeah. And I mean, I could see a fairly simple man in the middle attack, you know, in an environment where you're expecting to see like an acceptable use hotspot page. You just run this with your exploit code on there and they open the browser, you know, and Bob's your uncle, you got him. It's fairly scary.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it wasn't even a few months ago there was the last, you know, end of the world, you know, exploit was out there. I forgot what it was. It was like, I think I remember some of my customers were like all worried about it, but they're the same employers that don't even utilize Microsoft's free patch management systems. So it's like, how worried can you be about vulnerabilities and security when you still have, you know, RTM versions of Windows in your infrastructure?
You know, something else that comes to mind when I think of an exploit of this magnitude, and I mean, this is no small feat that these guys have found. If they had held on to this, what do you think this would have been worth, this exploit? Like, how many millions or billions of dollars do you think they could have gotten? Now, I'm not talking about them exploiting it. I'm talking about them selling it to governments.
How much
federal organizations.
Someone's already made on it. it was some researchers from, I think it was a researcher from Google and some universities and stuff that found it out at roughly the same time. But I mean, what's to say? Like, who's to say that it hasn't been used extensively prior to now? Like, it's been around for at least 10 years. So.
Jesus. So say you caught it 8 years ago. How much do you think you would have made off of this before, you know, before it actually got let loose into the wild?
That's the thing. It's like, you never, like, you're never afraid of the things you don't even hear about. Like, you know, most there's some people that are afraid of everything. But like, you know, we get afraid over, you know, this vulnerability, this vulnerability. Those are the ones we hear about. How many of them are in there that we have no idea of, but somebody does?
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
I mean, you know, those are out there. They exist, whether they're put there intentionally by organizations or not, they're there.
For sure. All right. Any last thoughts on Meltdown?
Nah. Don't think we've seen the last of it, but...
No. I mean, I think we'll all forget about it, and then a year from now, there'll be some gigantic exploit that utilizes this, and it's just hitting all these unpatched machines. Or like, which government's going to get infiltrated with it?
The Ubiquiti virus from, was it, you know, 2 years ago, you know, it had been patched for 8 or 9 months, and like it still took down entire WISPs because no one does anything.
Yeah, rolling around. All right, so an article I found the other day that Brock Tice put out, I think I actually found it on the Nanog list. I saw him put it out. He did a little write-up on how he did deploying 464 XLate for IPv6 only clients in a small WISP. And I thought it was somewhat interesting. It sounded like he was taking some very specific, like Linksys routers, flashing them with a firmware, and running the 464 XLate. I guess it's kind of like a little bit of code that runs in like OpenWRT or something to that effect. So he was actually having to throw those at all of the customer sites, and he was lamenting the fact that MikroTik didn't actually support it. Which, you know, I've been thinking about this. I've been looking at it more. How does a normal ISP, you know, like a small ISP, a WISP or whatever, how do they actually get away with running IPv6 in their network? Is that something that's really possible or plausible, or is that something you could really do these days?
What are your opinions? Or dual stack?
Well, I guess you could do dual stack, but I'm trying to say, if you want to give customers IPv6 addresses, how far can you get with that? Is that actually something that's viable and doable these days?
I mean, I think as long as you have, you know, something to translate to the V4 internet, I don't see why not, because anything an end user has, short of a PlayStation, has supported V6 for 10, 20 years already anyway.
Sure, the customer will support it, but what resources are they going to be accessing?
Xboxes don't.
Yeah, they do.
I thought Xbox is even do like Teredo tunnels.
They support the Teredo stuff, but yeah. a lot of the matchmaking stuff is still like still relies on V4. Azure hasn't released V6 into their environment yet. They also just bought a whole bunch of IP addresses recently. So like that tells me that they're not ready to go with it for quite some time. And even it was actually like a /8 or something that they bought.
Oh, wow. Like a Teredo tunnel. Yeah, like, if you've got one client that's IPv, so like on an Xbox, if you've got an IPv6 client and an IPv4, I don't think those guys can actually directly connect with a Teredo tunnel, right? Isn't there something like that? It's really only for bridging four customers together. It's something to that effect, right?
I don't remember the details, but I know someone from Microsoft was just chiming in on a Nanog thread in the past week about which platform support, which types of Teredo, and which, you know, V4, V6 dominant. Last post was just a couple days ago. Xbox Live and Teredo. It was Justin that started the thread. Justin Wilson started the thread. there was someone from Microsoft joined in on that list. Basically said how it works. I don't remember where it was now.
Well, I mean, but if you've got a client with an IPv6 address, he's going to be able to get to Netflix, right? So he's going to be able to Netflix and chill. He's going to be able to go to Facebook. He's going to be able to use Google and YouTube, which are going to be, I mean, that's a lot of your content right there, right? How about most of the CDNs? Are they going to support V6? So if you're going to like Cloudflare or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and like
Akamai.
Cloudflare, definitely.
Yeah, like yo, I believe every CDN has to. I mean, like they wouldn't have business if they didn't support v6 because it's so dominant. And like Cloudflare even has like a v6, upgrade service. It's even including upgrade enabler.
It's pretty cutting
edge.
They'll
take your v4. Website, and they'll present it in a V6 world.
Nice.
Of the providers, Cloudflare are one of the ones that proactively go out and fix things and release new features, whereas there is a lot of ones that aren't nearly as up to date and are stuck in their old ways. So I'm sure there's some out that are still V4 only at this point.
Gotcha. So if you've got customers that are really just eyeballs, it seems like the majority of their resources are probably going to be available on the V6. What's going to be something, maybe like your bank, maybe your bank's not going to be V6 compliant,
sure.
Or I don't know, like my website is only on V4, because I'm old school and I'm running on my own.
Most of your bits for sure, because most of the big content is V6. And most things people care about, entertainment sources are going to be V6. So, when you're looking at what sort of capacity it can take when you do, V4 to V6 translations, or you're netting whatever V4 traffic you have left to some number of V4 addresses, you've got to keep in mind that a lot of your traffic is going to be V6 already. So, don't look at your current upstream and say, well, I need to figure out how to do, 3 gigs of, NAT translation, because two of it is really going to be V6, I think.
Excuse me, goodness. All right. I really just need to break down and start doing some more experimentation with that, play with it a little bit more. I figured the Aussies had a little bit more V6 experience. Do you guys do anything over there? Or have you been fighting it as much as I have?
Apenix's been out of V4 for a while, haven't they?
Sorry, you're talking to me. Sorry, I missed that you were talking to me. I think they've still got a few little blocks left, because I know that we got one late last year as a for an ISP that hasn't had a block before. But I know that it's difficult to get new space. There's like 4 or 5 websites they actually refer you to now that are IP brokers. Mm. There's no sort of direct relationship between those, but they're sort of like, here's where you can go if you want to buy or trade for more IP addresses. So
nice.
Yeah, definitely pushing people down the IPv6 path where possible.
Yeah, I think all the different RARs had different policies and how to handle it. Aaron is largely just, we'll just use it till we run out, and when we run out, you're screwed. Right. I know, which it sounds like maybe, APNIC maybe had a similar policy. Ripe is out of IPs if you already have one. But if you're a new organization, you can get like a /22 or something like that. So, they set aside some block for, new entrants, which hindsight would have been nice to have an Aaron. I mean, I got mine, but lots of guys having difficulty starting up. And they want to do BGP, but they just have a, less than 24 now, and they don't want to spend $5,000 to buy a 24.
It's getting expensive, yeah, for sure. All right. So let's see. It's the, I guess, what is this? The very first cast of 2018. So I thought we could maybe talk a little bit about 2017. And I wanted to ask you guys, what is your favorite piece of gear from 2017? Maybe not necessarily that it arrived in 2017, but just that, I don't know, what was your favorite thing from 2017?
I would say my favorite item of... I'm going to have a serious answer later. My favorite item of 2017 is the SFP.
You're such a dingus. I'm gonna say
he's on that train.
He'll never give it up.
Well, like, and people keep getting on that train. That, you know, I don't have to drive the train anymore. I just keep seeing all the Facebook chats. People are like, you know, where's the SFPs? Because there's so many people need them and they don't even realize they need them.
For sure. I'm going to say my favorite piece of gear was the MikroTik Hap Lite. Believe it or not, it sounds like such a trash tier thing to say. It's a $20 router. It's got four ports and a wireless card. I basically use those things as networking duct tape. I use them all the time. A lot of times when I shouldn't use them. So I carry several of those. I always have at least 10 in stock. And they go out the door at least once or twice a week in all kinds of weird scenarios. I almost never turn on the wireless card, but it's great to have, to be able to sling out in different places. Also, if you've got somebody who's never heard of MikroTik, it's easy to just hand them one of those and let them run with it. So I'm going to say that's my favorite piece. What about you?
It's like a little Christmas present to carry around. So I'm gonna deviate a little bit. I'm gonna go three things, and they're not all networking stuff. But my first one was actually the same as yours. That's why I'm mixing it up. The Hap AC Lite. So the next model up, dual band wireless, the dual chain 5 gigahertz. Still 100 meg ports on it, but those things are dirt cheap. Like, and for deployments, like, we've rolled out probably like 12,000-13,000 of those devices now. We used to use some of the 2.4 gigahertz only ones, and we've moved to that, and it's gone great. The second thing would be, I recently upgraded my computer, and I've gone to having a little NUC box as my main computer and an external graphics card dock. And that has been awesome. I'd been looking at it for a while, and I had a really old big box that I used to work on, and now the whole thing is this big and sits behind the television, and yeah, it's good. It's worked really well.
I remember you were experimenting with the thin client gaming or whatever. Have you given that up? Or are you still doing that?
So I haven't given it up, but it's not feasible here in Australia. Like, we still just don't have enough bandwidth to most places, and the cost of data is still too high. In the US, it worked really well. I was using a couple of systems, Paperspace, Liquid Sky, and a couple of others, which are all, yeah, it's basically like remote desktop to a gaming machine, and they've got like GPU accelerated machines, and Microsoft has released changes to the remote desktop protocol that allow that sort of high bandwidth streaming, which is, it works well, but you need sort of a minimum of 30 megabits of in-stream, like downstream capacity to you all the time. And you need to have low latency to wherever the data center is that your machines are hosted. So that's been great. But I like, rather than upgrading my machine here to just replacing new parts, I decided to go down the NUC path, and in sort of 1 or 2 years, I can just replace that box, and keep the external GPU box, just replace the graphics card in that. So that'll be cool.
That's cool. And what's the third thing?
I will say it's kind of 2016, 2017, because this has been around for a while now, but the virtual reality stuff. So I bought myself a HTC Vive. It is amazing. If someone hasn't tried VR before, get one of those devices, give it a try. If you have anywhere in your house where you've got sort of 2x3 or 3x3 meters of free space, it's as you would expect. You put on a headset and you're looking around in another space. It doesn't make you dizzy. I definitely used to get dizzy using the early version of the Oculus stuff. And it's a lot of fun. It's like playing Fruit Ninja with your hands for half an hour, and then you wake up the next morning and you're like, why do my muscles hurt so much? Oh, that's right, I'm not fit, and I just did a whole bunch of exercise yesterday.
That's hilarious. So are you only playing games with it, or have you used it for, I mean, can you watch movies and stuff on it?
You can watch movies and stuff on it. The resolution is not great yet. Like it's decent, so you can see everything, but I reckon we'll see a few new releases, better lenses and things as well, so you have a wider field of view. But yeah, there's a mode where you can log in and your friend can be sort of 50 kilometers away and you sit next to them there in a movie theater and you wave at them and you're watching a movie on a big screen that's in front of you. So yeah, at some point maybe we won't have TVs anymore in our apartments. We'll just put on a set of glasses and, oh look, there's the TV on the wall in virtual reality. And
you know, when you were a kid and you kind of speculated what the future is like, does this feel like this is the future to you? Does this feel like this is the thing that's gonna...
It really does. Putting this on, like standing on a ledge like 100 stories up and looking down and your palms are sweating and you're like, yeah, okay, this feels pretty real.
Because I used to, like when I was a kid, I was always fascinated by those old Disney shorts or whatever, like on the end of cartoons where they'd show like home of the future and it would show this kitchen where this thing pops up out of the middle. You know what I mean? Like that used to just blow my mind. Like even when I was a kid, it was hokey, right? Because that stuff was like from the 50s or the 60s. But I always thought, you know, yeah, that could be what the, you know, so I've always sort of like tried to speculate and imagine what the future is like. And I hear you talk about the VR stuff, like I kind of hearken back to that. Like I feel like you're talking about the future. I'm doing air quotes here. The future.
If we're talking the future, honorable mention to the smartwatches that have come out. I remember the first time I was like walking downstairs at night one time with my smartwatch on, and I turned on the flashlight and just doing this Dick Tracy sort of thing as I'm walking down the stairs. I'm like, yeah, or answering phone calls. Yeah, no, I got that. We got that.
Now you go back to the Get Smart where you answer your shoe.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that'll be the next one. I mean, there's a lot of space to store batteries in a shoe, so.
Yeah, there you go. What did you actually come up with anything serious, Mike?
Oh, yeah. No, I had some serious stuff, but it was just, SFPs are important. Have kind of a mix of things that I have tried and I haven't tried, or things that have come out. The new Microtik chips in their CRSs, they haven't gotten the software to using all the capabilities yet in the chips. But if they program everything into Microtik that those switches can do, or those switch chips can do, they'll be pretty amazing. Being able to do, line rate MPLS on a, $300 switch,
theoretically, the chipset can do MPLS in the hardware, right?
Well, right, yeah. Yeah, so all these things that they can do in hardware now, that they just need to make the software up to the product.
And I think while you're talking about that, they're sort of working towards that in this, 641 version of RouterOS. They switched the bridging to where now you just configure bridges and software like you always did. And if it's got hardware offload capability, well, then it'll enable it. So I guess theoretically, with the same thing with the MPLS, if you're configuring MPLS and it can do it in hardware, it'll just kick that on, which I think is pretty cool. That way it's... was that configuration parity across all platforms? So you get to configure it in the same way. And if you get a speed boost, great. If you don't, well, that's too bad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, that's also, that's probably the platform that has the goal, for next year if they do it. But then also, kind of going to, basically copying RFL. RFL was just copied, AT&T, 50 years ago. But, with their, horn antennas on the radios, because the horns work really, really great for anybody not in a rural, really rural setting. Because they just block out the noise everywhere other than where you're pointed. And, the ubiquitous symmetrical ones are, it's kind of nice they're able to, because on most horns it's a symmetric pattern. if you have 90-degree antenna, it's 90 degrees vertical, or, well, elevation, 90 degrees azimuth. And Ubiquiti made one that only does 45 on the elevation. Still a lot more than a regular sector, and the pattern gets a little dirtier, but the pattern's better than a regular sector still, and you're getting a couple dB of gain out of it. So those sorts of things really help, you know, WISPs getting closer in shots. I've seen some of the pictures in like New Zealand where, you know, it appears a mountain and, you know, there's nobody out there, and yet there's 15 horns on one tower. I'm like, well, there has to be people there. It's just covered in antennas.
They're out there somewhere. All right, well, while we're talking about this, what do you want to see for 2018? If something like necessarily doesn't exist but could materialize, what would you like to see? Put it within the realm of possibilities. So, like, don't say version 7 come out. That's just ridiculous.
But I would say, SF and tower radios, which, yeah, I'd expect that. But no, it's, I know that like the EPMP 3000, which should be shipping in the next month, it'll have FPs on it. So, you know, there'll be one other manufacturer doing it at normal pricing. So it's, you know, people got to fall eventually, you know.
Yeah. I would like to see a HAP AC version that's got AF or AT compliant PoE input on it. From Microtik. I would love to see that. You know, using like the Wave 2 AC chipsets or whatever. I think that's doable. I would love to see something compliant, because I would love to use really cheap switches that are compliant with those things.
I'll add to that. I'd like to see the PoE CRS that's coming out. So Microtik switch with PoE out. Then we could sort of standardize, not have to sort of find another 24 volt PoE switch, which is, there's not many other options out there. So it's like Ubiquiti, Netonix, I think one or two other sort of Chinese brands. But
IgniteNet would have it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Needs to be reasonably affordable too. So.
Yeah.
I know I can pick up an edge switch with 24 and 48 volt PoE for a couple $100. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know I can get a 48 Cisco 3550 for $40 off of eBay. So yeah. I would love to just buy. And those things are tanks. Like,
well, then you've got,
seriously, one of those will outlast you.
Yeah.
So that's the downside of that.
No, there's no downside to that. I've deployed hundreds of those things, and I've only lost a small handful.
In the same location?
No, all over the place. They get weird. So I know, like, some Cisco switches have problems. Like, if you get a brownout, I've had this before where, you know, it's just kind of a sag in the power that lasts a couple seconds. It'll actually wipe the config on a Cisco switch, which is, it's not a fun day.
That seems no.
Nobody's perfect. Everybody's got problems.
But that day is made better by Unimus, because you can just restore your configuration.
That's right. Oh, that's let's talk about favorite products of 2017. There you go, Unimus. I actually bought a licensed copy. The cheapskate asshole that I am, I actually went and bought a copy of it. So I'm using it for myself and for some of my customers. It's great.
I don't know if I've paid any or not. I was going to, and there was a problem with, like, I couldn't choose, like, the form of payment I wanted to through his payment portal on PayPal. And so, like, you know, he had to do a bug report and whatnot on that, and he fixed it. But I was busy, and nothing had followed back up again.
Yeah, when I did it, I got, like, a fraud alert, because it, all of a sudden, there was this payment to some weird random European bank. I was like, yeah, it's okay. So yeah, it went through.
I nearly got it across the line a couple of times, but I think our implementation is basically going to be across all of the systems that we manage. So every switch, every router, and it's that sort of yearly fee that I need to convince people is worth not trying to develop something ourselves. It's like, well, we could probably do sort of 50% of it in like a week or two, but I mean, if you've got someone that's maintaining that sort of system and doing the updates and supporting new platforms, then I would always rather push that out to someone else.
Yeah, it keeps getting better all the time. And I think also the fact that you know the guy that writes it means anytime you have a problem, you probably got pretty good support.
There's a big issue. I'm sure I could talk to someone. Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody would take your call, I think.
Yeah, so. I think in the past 2 months I've contributed another like 3 or 4 platforms to it. I've got some more lined up as soon as I can figure out how to get the config out of the device. I'll have some more for him.
Yeah, I've got a Sienna project coming up soon. Maybe I can get him access to that thing. Who knows?
I think he just added a Sienna platform. I'm not sure which one.
Nice.
That's probably it. The biggest thing of 2017 is Ominimus, and lots of people didn't really come out with anything that fun this year, or at least ship it, I should say. We're talking about actually 2018, what we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I said what I wanted. I guess you guys kind of chimed in.
Yeah, for sure. I know while we're talking about software in 2018, I've been working with a partner of mine on that control software to kind of do the hosted control for people kind of out in the Wisp environment, right? To do the managed routers. We actually have some code up and working and it looks pretty. He's good at the pretty stuff. I say he's good. He bought a template and it looks really good. It's up and functioning and he's actually pulling stuff out of the microticks. He's crazy, man, because he's been doing like this distributed load stuff for so long that he's got it to where all these things like throw a job into a database that gets picked and this stuff auto scales. It's bananas. So he's got it to where I think just with the code we have now, it'll scale to like a couple 100,000 individual routers monitored and controlled off the infrastructure we have in place. So nice. Hopefully we'll actually have something, I don't know, ready for some beta testers in the next month or two. And then, I mean, other than every unwilling participant that I force into it, I mean, like actual beta testers. So I don't know, maybe I'll have something up and functioning and ready for mass distribution by Wispapalooza this year. I'm hoping anyway, we'll see. That'll be fun.
So,
is it integrate with Unimus?
I bet I could talk to a guy. I bet we could make it work. Let's see.
Wispapalooza was a positive impact on you. You liked it?
I did.
Next year?
I thought it was cool. I'm going to try and go next year. Maybe I'll have to talk to Thomas. Maybe we can share a booth with whatever this thing is. I'm not sure. We're working on names. I guess, what is that, the hardest part of the whole project is coming up with a name? So we'll figure something out. Something that I saw you post, Mike, the other day. It was something about sharing tower space with other ISPs, you know, to get on there, something like that. And it got me thinking, do either of you guys or anybody out there listening, have you ever set up deals with other ISPs to sell their service? Like, you know, like everybody around you set up a mutual agreement. Hey, if I turn on a customer to you, I get $5 a month for that customer. You know what I mean? Basically, you become a reseller of their services, you know, because it seems like a lot of guys have kind of this weird adversarial relationship. And I was thinking if, you know, you could actually get something out of turning a customer over to the competition, maybe it won't be so adversarial anymore, you know? Have you guys ever heard of people doing that or thought of doing that?
Yeah, I know that tons of people do it. Like in my area, I just give them away. I'm like, you know, it's just goodwill towards the other Wisps. Like, you know, I can't. Bob can. Go ahead, Bob. Take care of it. But I know that some of them had kind of a reseller thing going. I know there was a lot of down in like the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, we're talking probably 10 years ago or more. But, you know, maybe like a half dozen WISPs that all had reseller agreements with each other. And I don't remember the term, my deal, but, you know, this seemed to be pretty happy for everybody for a while. I see, you know, the type of WISPs that are, you know, afraid of everybody and everything. And so then, you know, they don't work with anybody. So this isn't a them, obviously, because you have to be able to trust people that you work with to a certain degree. And then, you know, there's other guys, like there's guys in Texas where it's all like, you know, let's just work together. And, you know, I give you a few bucks, you give me a few bucks, we'll call it a day. Is there much of that by you guys?
Me? I don't know anybody that doesn't. That's why it sort of intrigued me, the concept of it. I mean, I've seen it in other areas. So with virtually every major ISP, you know, you can get a reseller agreement where, you know, I bring a customer to you. I can either get a one-time payment or maybe a monthly based off of their contract, stuff like that. You know, so I see it in a lot of different industries. In the data center industry, people set that up fairly often.
I don't see it. I think it's, I think in general, it'd be very hard to facilitate. Just if it's small companies, I could understand there might be sort of an agreement there. But most of the stuff I've done is sort of just handshakes and, hey, this customer's over here. Do you want to talk to them? Or even telling the customer themselves, look, we can't provide anything there. You should talk to one of these guys. And I'll always go through the ones that we have good relationships first and then leave the ones that are just the regular providers at the end. So it's there's no sort of formality about it. It's just these people exist. We've used them. They're really good. Go talk to them. So.
Yeah, and I suppose it depends upon a lot on how many WISPs are in your area too. And I've heard guys talking where, like those guys that you were talking to, Greg, in Vegas, from I think it was Washington. We went on the mimosa dinner. Mm-hmm. How they were the only ones in the area because they were like part of the, you know, Indian reservation or whatever. So like there were no other ones. They were the only ones that else could build. And so there's that kind of stuff where, you know, you're literally the only one. You don't have anybody else to resell, you know, with. Well, trading. I mean, you know, obviously they could have, you know, one way relationships there. But then you got, like, I've got, I think, like 12 or 13 WISP competitors. Need for you to hand it over to somebody else. So that kind of depends upon your market. Yeah, in my area, I'm the guy that I'm talking about. I think he got into a disagreement with the tower owner at the end of a lease and was vacating the tower. And I think he's just looking for homes for as many other of his customers that he could. And it seems like he thinks there's a bunch of them could go on some of my towers. So he was talking about, working out something. You know, we haven't really worked it out yet. For access to the access point, so you can get, you know, your information out of it. But then he was actually talking about building in a diverse licensed path to supply his own customers. There's a lot of different ways you can do it too. Just straight cash for cash, so that they're, you know, using some of your infrastructure, some of theirs. I'd like to hear feedback from other people. That's what they do. Yeah,
for sure. So moving on the list, I see you have a playlist of interesting WISP-related YouTube videos. Give me the 30 seconds on that, Mike.
It's in response to some people talking in one of the WISP groups about, a WISP place on YouTube. I'm like, well, there's the Brothers WISP, and actually someone else beat me by a few hours on that. And they're like, well, no, not that. Like, where we can share, like, all of our own stuff. Like, own videos that we've done of, installations or things that we've accomplished or cool things we've seen WISP-related. And so I thought, well, so there's somebody else putting together their own channel and trying to get, scale on that, that would just make a playlist on our channel. We'll add anything anybody wants as long as it's not, bad. Any, pro Stalin videos or anything. has to at least pass time.
Gotcha. All right, guys. Well, we're hitting that hour mark, so let's stick a fork in it. One last question for everybody. Andrew, over the holidays, what did you binge watch on Netflix?
Oh, we've got a bunch of stuff going at the moment. Travelers Season 2 has just come out, which we've been watching. Still haven't caught up with that Bright movie, though, but I'm hearing good things from friends. So.
I thought it wasn't bad. I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was terrible. Will Smith's always good, right?
Yeah. But yeah, Travelers is pretty good. So we'll see how this second season goes.
I saw Thomas saying that the new season of Black Mirror came out and he was going to binge watch it. And I was thinking, God, that's the equivalent of go ahead and putting the gun in your mouth. That show is like so effing depressing. It's just so depressing. I can do one episode a week. Man, that thing just drags me down. It's well made, but...
Whew, you rough. Watch it, it's like, yeah, I could see that happening in a few years.
It's tough. We started binge watching what did we watch? The Magicians. I think it's like a sci-fi show. It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's kind of like Harry Potter meets Narnia meets something else. Something sort of mysterious. It's pretty cool, pretty interesting. I liked it enough to where I went ahead and grabbed the audiobooks for it, so I'm gonna listen to those, see how that goes. And then, of course, the Doctor Who Christmas special. Did you watch that yet?
Yep.
You excited for the new female Doctor?
Yeah, it's I don't have any problem with it. People who have been complaining, missing the fact that they're watching a show about an alien who time travels. So.
And this is the piece they can't handle. This is the piece that doesn't compute.
They did kind of address that in the Christmas issue a little bit, like the just old way of thinking.
It's very cleverly done. Good. I'm of the opinion, I don't care who the Doctor is, as long as they're a good actor, just be good, doesn't matter. Let's see. Did you watch the Great Christmas Bake Off? They did. I'm a big Great British Bake Off fan. So they did a Christmas one, and then they did a Great Holiday Bake Off, which is they brought back some more previous season people and did another show. So you got two saved up. And nice. This is maybe sacrilege, but I like Prue better than Mary Berry. I'm gonna go out there and say it. I'm a Prue fan. So, and Mike has no idea what we're talking about. Mike, what did you binge watch?
I'm just sitting here looking pretty.
Yeah. What did you binge watch over the holidays?
I didn't really have time to binge watch anything.
Oh, that's right. You're dealing with that new customer.
I binge worked. Was it earlier this week? Was it like I worked for like 40 out of 50 hours? I was just dealing with the critical stuff. Still the aftermath. I don't watch a lot of TV.
Netflix isn't TV, it doesn't count.
But I just started watching because it came out last month, the next season of The Grand Tour is out. Grantor was the three guys that did Top Gear on PC as their Amazon show, and good. I haven't been doing it so much, but Kate's been binge watching a lot of Netflix lately because like a week ago, satellite went out, and it's below zero, so I'm not planning on going on a metal roof with snow to figure out why it's out.
Solid. Like,
and you know, I'm not
fickle.
So she's learned how to use the little Bluetooth keyboard that we have. She's been watching things on Netflix and you know various of the network websites.
That's cool. That's killer. All right, Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
I'm busy, so don't.
Okay, don't. Fair enough. Andrew Cox.
Unless you're giving me money, then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, any donations are accepted, of course. Andrew Cox, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
admin@microtech-routeros.com. But yeah, I'm the same as Mike. It's too busy. Wait until the end of January.
If you want to get a hold of me, you can find me at gregsoul.com over my blog. There's a little contact me button, I think. Maybe it's a link. I don't know. Whatever. It's there. You can find me. I don't blog very often, but occasionally still do. If you want to drop us questions, comments, facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. All of that good material you see up there is that guy up in my right-hand corner. That's Mike Hammond. He's the one putting all that good stuff up, and he's the one that's Johnny on the spot with questions and responses to your comments. Also, believe it or not, we do Patreon, and then due to Mike's prodding today, his gentle prodding, we picked up a couple of more patrons today, which is pretty awesome. So that's
what do you mean by gentle prodding?
Patreon.com/thebrotherswiss.
Yeah, because like we gotta work out some way to fix this. is a bulldog clip and epoxy.
Looks like it's working just fine. I don't know why you're complaining.
And for those that aren't quite sure, see, well, actually, I got more reactions than we have Patreon patrons, so I need
the people liking it.
So
you know what's funny too is I've seen most of the patrons, we're the only people they support, so they're actually joining Patreon just to support us, which I think is that's pretty cool, man. I really appreciate that. Also, if you're old school and you want to get a hold of us, it's contact@thebrotherswisp.com. I don't see much stuff come in through there, but if you have to, send it away.
Also on the old school thing, combined with the Patreon thing, if you're into this Patreon sending people money over the internet thing, if it's enough, I can just meet you for like a box of cash.
That's the preferred
real
method.
Currency, not Nam Dong. We're like a box enough to fly there to get it.
Gotcha. Yeah. They're going to make an indecent proposal.
I just wanted to add to that as well. One of the Patreon things, a few of the people that have jumped in there, we now have a Slack set up just for Brothers Wisp. So we have a few people that get to hang out in there and chat with us, and we help each other out with problems and bitch about other internet service providers and net neutrality and...
Yeah, I think it was at Michael.
Depends where in the globe you are as to what.
Yeah, he had some questions about Radius authentication for MikroTik VPN and answered a few questions, and then he got stuck, and we were able to kind of help him through that. So you know, it's a good quick method to ask a couple of questions here and there.
Yeah, I had something useful to say, but I forgot it. So
yeah, and the good thing about the Slack is. Not everybody can make it to these casts. It's really, honestly, inconvenient, man. And you guys are freaking rock stars for showing up. You're heroes. But it's really easy for everybody to be in the Slack all the time and answer questions kind of as they come and go. So if you want to get a hold of us, that's actually probably the best way of doing it.
Yeah, it's, for sure. The best way to get a hold of us is to give us money so we will.
You can pay us to be your friend. That's great. Yeah. All right. I guess that's it. Questions, comments, keep them coming, guys. We sure appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
See you.
Catch you later.